Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. It's a new year, but it is the dead of winter, and a lot of times this time of year, I like to reflect back at kind of the signature wintertime battle of World War II. And 66 years ago this week, the Battle of the Bulge was right about in the middle. It started December 16th, 1944, didn't end till nearly the end of January 1945. 40-plus days of intense battle in intense weather in the worst winter that Germany and France and Belgium, that European continent, had really ever seen. So we're going to talk to a Battle of the Bulge survivor today, and I really do mean survivor. He's got the Purple Heart to prove it. 87-year-old Harmon Atwater of Tulare, California, my guest today. I say of Tulare, California, Harmon, but you didn't grow up in Tulare, California. You were born in Canada and grew up in Maine. I guess maybe that weather prepared you for the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, it prepared me for the weather. The weather caused 80% of the deaths in frozen feet, frozen hands. So that prepared me, because in northern Maine, where we lived when we left Canada, it was the same weather that we got in Belgium. So it prepared me in that way.
I want to take you back further than the Battle of the Bulge. One question I like to ask every veteran I interview, because everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, how that registered for you at the time?
Yes. I was in the little town of Mapleton, Maine. It's about 170 miles north of Bangor, Maine. And I was working on a farm, working my board and going to high school. And, of course, December the 7th, there was not much farming, but there was chores to do, cows and horses and pigs and whatever. And I remember doing chores around noontime when we heard about it. And it didn't really sink in, because I'm too young to understand what is taking place, except somebody is attacking the United States of America. And that sunk in after a while.
And that was just a few days after your 18th birthday. So you were getting to the point where you were old enough to serve. And did it sink in eventually that maybe you would go have to be part of this war that was going on?
Yes, I knew that it was going to happen. And being on a farm, the farmer's son was already in the Army. So he was sole occupant of the farm. And he asked me if I would like to be deferred for 6 months. So this happened. And so farming was tough, because all the young men were leaving. And I got another 6 months, but that was the end. Then I had to show up.
So you were drafted into the Army?
My folks lived in Hartford, Connecticut. They had gone down to work in the war plants from Maine. And it's about 300 miles south of us. So I stayed on the farm and worked and kept my girlfriend busy, interested in me. And when I got my draft notice, we went to Connecticut to visit. So they transferred my papers to Connecticut, Hartford. So I stayed there a few days, and my father said, "Are you looking for a job?" And I decided I best do something. I worked about 5 weeks at Colt, Patton, and Firearms to make guns and ammunition. Every day when I come home from work, I'd walk by the recruiting office, and I'm thinking, man, this is just being crazy to prolong this thing. So I went in and signed up for the Navy. I appeared in 5 days, I think I had, in Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And I appeared there, and they were short on infantrymen, and press on Navy people. So I ended up in the infantry.
Which is probably what you're trying to avoid when you signed up for the Navy, right?
So it was all right. I took my 17 weeks basic training in Camp Croft, South Carolina. And it was good. I liked it because I was hard as a nail, you know, from working on a farm. And I don't know if Paul is a city boy or not, but the city boys had some tough times ahead of them. But I took 17 weeks and I got a 11-day leave, and then I shipped from New York Harbor, from Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. And man, they shipped you out quick from there.
And somewhere in this time period, if I do the math correctly, you decided that that girlfriend was going to be more than just a girlfriend, right? How did you make that decision to get married before you headed out?
That was decided a long time ago. I decided when I met her, when she was 10 years old, I told my father, I said, I'm going to marry that girl. And we dated in high school. And October the 13th, we got married because I could see it coming, you know. And she wasn't fighting it, so we got married, and she had a wonderful family, her mother, and she lived with her grandparents. Her mother was a nurse. But these days just passed, you know, and first thing I know, it was time to do something that I had to do, you know.
So that was October 13th, 1942. You got married to a young lady named Dawn, and 68 years later, you're still married to her. That's something.
I wouldn't trade her for two more just like her, no. But we got married, like we said, October 13th, 42. And being in Maine, when it rains there in October, it freezes on the road. The snow hadn't come yet. But we drove 14 miles to the minister that my Don's mother picked up, I guess a friend of hers, and had a 1928 Chevrolet. I was young and kind of hyper, I guess, and every once in a while I would swap ends on that icy road. Don's mother, as I said, she was a nurse, and she's sort of straight-laced, and I don't think she ever thought that I'd make a good husband for Don. But I think I proved her wrong. But that was about 7 o'clock at night that we went to get married, and the ice just kept getting worse. And she wanted to stay somewhere all night, and I said, "Nah." I said, "This old car has done ice before." And we swapped ends a couple of times, and she was sitting in the back seat, and I heard her say to Don, "Aren't we going the wrong way?" I'd give it another flip and get straightened out. But we got it done, and she and I became good friends. It took a while, because I was quite young. What I didn't know hadn't been in my head yet, you know?
And when you say swap ends, you mean that car was spinning 360s on the ice?
Oh, you just swap ends in the rear-wheel drive, remember, see? And all you do is touch the gas a little bit and cut the front wheel a little bit, and it just flip ends just like nothing. But, of course, there wasn't no speed to it neither. Like 25, 30 miles an hour was about 20 miles an hour on that ice is about all you dare.
That drive just to get married sounds like it was one of the more eventful drives of your life, but you've put a few miles on the road since then. How many miles do you think you've driven in your life with your career in trucking?
I would say I drove one truck since 1967. I hired on with this Kane Trucking in Tulare, and I drove the same truck for 20 years, and I put over 2.5 million miles on it. They got new trucks in, replacement every few years, you know, but I felt good with the old one, and it fit me good, and of course the maintenance was kept up good on them, you know. It was just, so I just drove that old truck about 2.5 million miles. I drove a lot before that because I was 44 when I started with him, so I had a few miles on me before that.
And you're not done racking up the miles either. What do you do every summer?
When they get all work to do, they work construction on the highway, putting oil mix on the road. I hire on for a few days or maybe just one day once in a while. It's just right for me. And it makes it good for the company, too, because you can't find a man just off the street. Maybe he can drive, but he don't know how to spread oil. So this is works good for both sides.
So when we're in Tulare County and we go across a smooth road that's been repaired and the potholes are fixed, we have you to thank?
Yeah, but the rough ones don't thank me for, but the good ones you can thank me for. I appreciate it.
You'll take the credit, not the blame. I like that. Well, in before all those miles were put on the road, and as you say, before your second, third, and fourth sons were born, you had to head overseas and leave behind a wife and a young son. How hard was that for you to do?
That was the toughest thing I think I ever done or ever will do. There was nothing during the war was as tough as that. I wouldn't want to do it again because, millions of young men did it, but leaving the wife and the little boy, mother and fathers is tough to leave, but leaving the wife and little boy, it's really hard. And I never got over it. I think maybe when I get home I get over it, but sometimes I think about it and Don and I get talking about what she went through, you know. And she was very fortunate that she had her family, my family, to kind of look after her, which I knew would happen, so that relieved my mind greatly. But it was a tough thing. We all have to do tough things, you know.
And there were still plenty more tough things for you to face in the service overseas with the 26th Infantry Division. We're going to hear some of those stories from Harmon Atwater. When we come back, we'll hear about how he earned the Silver Star and the Purple Heart. Harmon Atwater, 87 years old of Tulare, California, our guest today. We'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a program where each week we visit with veterans of World War II, trying to honor them for their service and sacrifice, hopefully preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way learn a thing or two, maybe be inspired by their love for our country and their commitment. Harmon Atwater, our guest today, he's 87 years old. In the summertime, you'll still find him driving a truck, spreading oil on the roads in this area. He hasn't quit driving trucks out there, did it for most of his life. And in the service, he had plenty of adventures, too. When we left off, he was heading overseas, leaving behind his young wife and child. That wife he's still married to today, 68 years after they first tied the knot. But Harmon, heading overseas, did you have any idea what you were in for? You talked about how being a farm boy prepared you for basic training. I imagine there was nothing that prepared you for what you saw once you got across the Atlantic.
There's no way you can be prepared for what took place. I left from Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. We understood we was going to be there 7 days. Don and my boy Brian is visiting my folks in Hartford, Connecticut. Well, that's just a short ways down the road to Camp Hilmer, New Jersey. So I called her, told her where I was, and she said, I'll come down on the next train. So my mother and father kept the boy. So she got a room in New York City. Can you imagine a little kid like that finding a room all by herself? I mean, that is a miracle to start with. And it was an hour ride by train to where she's going to be. So I get in there and found her. I don't know how I could find her today, a place like that. But she had a nice little room, so I could only get the one pass. You must remember that all those in that barracks were all strangers to me, and I was stranger to them. And they found out that my wife was in New York and I'd been to see her. And I get down there and they said, here's a pass for you. I got a pass for 7 days from strangers. Now that's a miracle in itself. And I didn't know the guy's name, didn't know what he looked like. So I'd go in to visit, stay 8 hours, and then I'd have to report back. The sixth day, I told Don, I said, you best go home. I said, this thing is getting close to me leaving. So I put her in a taxi and said goodbye again. And I get back to the base, and the trucks were lined up, and they were loaded. And one of the guys recognized me. He said, Atwater, all your equipment's on here. Just board the truck. That's how close I come to missing the truck, because they left a day early. So anyway, it worked out okay. This is another high point in my life before things started happening bad. Was I went overseas on the Queen Mary, and that was a highlight. 5 days, we landed in Scotland, Clyde River. We could board the ship that evening, late in the evening. It must have been 10 o'clock or so. There was ships as far as you could see, hundreds of them. And we left. I got up at 5 the next morning, went up on deck, and there wasn't a ship in sight, nowhere. And I asked one of the sailors, I said, where'd the all the ships go? He called me Yank. He said, Yank, he said, we don't fool around with them slow boys. He said, we leave them. I mean, that was amazing that ship was that fast.
And that big. There are probably a lot more people on that ship than you had in your hometown in Maine.
22,000 on that. And Maple in Maine had about 560. We landed there, never got to any barracks. We just boarded a train, and we had to go clear across England. We stopped somewhere at a railroad station, and there's big signs and a guy recruiting men for the 101st Airborne. And there was 7 of us sort of chumming together. And we talked it over, and one of them made a call at that station, and just nothing flat. There was an army truck come. It took 7 of us to the barracks where they training for the 101st Airborne. And I thought I was tougher than nails, but they give us another 3 weeks training on the double. I mean, everything was in a hurry. I made one jump, and then they gather you in the business room or whatever, hall, and ask if anybody wants out. He said, now's the time, because if you don't want to get out now, you're in. So 7 of us said we didn't want no more to do with the 101st Airborne. But we wasn't long getting to France from then on.
Yeah, you didn't have a cakewalk, but in looking back, are you glad you made that decision that you decided not to stay with the 101st?
Oh, yes, because when we went in to France, we ran across a lot of the 101st Airborne that had parachuted into the back country. They had great losses. Great losses.
While people were storming the beach on D-Day, they were jumping behind enemy lines, right?
Right, they jumped in there. The plans were good, but things didn't go according to plans.
And the same can probably be said for a lot of what you experienced with the 26th Infantry Division, the 328th Infantry Regiment. And as you said, it wasn't long before you were over there. You didn't land on Omaha Beach on June 6th, but it wasn't long after that. What did you see? Just June 9th is when you got there. What did that look like when you stepped on to that beach on June 9th? I imagine it was hard to miss the reality of war.
There were still occasionally bodies floating in the water that didn't make it to shore. If they had made it to shore, the tide had come in and took them out. Things were getting not back to normal, but they were moving. The troops that were coming in on MLSTs was directly moving, either marching or on trucks. They were inland quite a ways on the third day somewhere. Now, Omaha Beach wasn't too far, but the other beaches had moved in, didn't have the problems. Well, they didn't have the tough beach that Omaha was. Like I said, I took infantry training, but I didn't have any machine gun training except just to fire. During training, we fired him a couple of times probably, but no basic information. When I got inland, me and thousands of others were replacements. We didn't know it. We thought we was an outfit, but we were replacements for those that didn't make it, were killed or wounded. They moved us right in, and all of a sudden I was in the 328th Battalion, 26th Division, and I had not even heard of them. My name come up, and this sergeant said, could you fire a machine gun? Yeah, I guess so. And he said, well, we got an opening here for a 30 caliber water-cooled machine gun. And he said, you've been selected. From then on, I learned a lot about a machine gun in a short while. From then on until May the 8th, 45, that was my responsibility.
And a lot happened between then and May 8th of 1945, like the instance that earned Harmon the Silver Star, as well as the one that has a Purple Heart on his wall here in Tulare, California. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll ask him to tell us about that. Harmon Atwater, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue now with 87-year-old World War II veteran Harmon Atwater. If you ever have a chance to visit the log cabin-style home he built outside of Tulare, California, you'll notice on the wall a Silver Star medal as well as a Purple Heart. And I want to get the story behind the two of those. You heard Harmon describe being assigned to a 30-caliber machine gun. And somewhere along the way, he realized that as they were tasked to take out German machine gun nests, it probably was true that the enemy was focusing on his machine gun as a target. And with the Silver Star and the Purple Heart, we're going to get both sides of that coin. Let's talk first, Harmon, about the instance that earned you the Silver Star. This came before you ended up at the Battle of the Bulge. Where were you, and what did you do to deserve one of the most prestigious medals that the military gives out?
I ate one of their home-cooked meals. This was in Hanskirch, Germany, and we got a call that they needed a water-cooled machine gun. Water-cooled machine gun holds about 4 pints of water, surrounds the barrel to help cool it. Air-cooled fires the same, but the barrel gets hot, and it's very inaccurate then. So this day, they were moving, so they said, bring the air cool. It's easier to handle. I had a empty clip, ammunition clip, their cotton. Would tie one end around the barrel and one around the handle and carry it on my shoulder, make it more maneuverable. You have a tripod you could set them on, but they're very difficult to move with that on. This day, we're moving and we're getting fired on, but not much. All of a sudden, a German machine gun opens up on us. Well, of course, everybody hits the ground and stays there. That's a smart thing to do, but pretty soon, they stay there. Like, it seemed like minutes, and nothing was happening, and guys were getting wounded. For unknown reason, I'd had enough of that, and I had the firepower, so I stood up and fired that gun at them, and just sighting it by what the, so you got tracers every fifth round. It's a tracer in the belt. You could see where they was hitting and where they were in the air and where they was hitting the ground. I didn't know what was taking place during that time, but there was an old rotten stub behind me about 8 foot tall. And this Sergeant Roberts was laying on the ground. He was in charge of the operation. He said that stub kept getting shorter. And then he realized they wasn't bringing their firepower down low enough to get me and some of the others. The ones that they've been hitting were in out of ways from where I was. So evidently the elevation on their guns, they couldn't get down low enough. Just this all happened in, say, 32 seconds or 42 seconds. I mean, it was quick. And we got them. We got them out, and we moved on. They got by that one and didn't need us anymore, so they sent us back to where we was bivouacked. About 2 months later, I got a call to go down to the CO. I said, what have I done now?
I've seen your good conduct medal, so it must not have been anything too bad.
No. A lot of things went through my mind, and walking down there, it wasn't very far. Captain called me in his office and presented me with a Silver Star. And I said, what's this for? Oh, he said, Sergeant Roberts, you haven't talked to him? And I said, no, he wasn't our sergeant. I said, no. He said, he put you in for the Silver Star. I said, what for? Well, he said, knocking out that machine gun nest. I said, I'll be darned. And he said, I'll mail it home for you. But that was Hanskirk, Germany. That's where I got my hearing hurt, too, there. But that was interesting. But you see, to get an award of any kind, somebody's got to report you, good or bad. I would thank Sergeant Roberts for that. He was a boxer, an ex-boxer, and he said, I could have knocked that machine gun out, but he said I didn't have the machine gun to do with.
Well, and it didn't seem like much to you at the time, it sounds like, but in trying to picture it in my mind, it sounds like if you hadn't stepped up and been brave enough to fire on them, that no one would have, and probably a lot more American lives would have paid that price if you hadn't stepped up and illuminated the fact that they couldn't hit you while you could hit them.
But as soon as I stood up, I know it wasn't a minute, and they all rallied. I mean, they come out of their holes where they was depressions in the ground, you know. They were all brave men, but they were doing the right thing to get down until something took place with that machine gun nest, because the German machine gun was so much faster than ours.
The Schmeisser burp guns that could saw you in half because they fired so many rounds. I've got to ask you, I'm sure you've thought about this over the years, maybe talked to your beautiful bride about it. What possessed you to stand up? Because if everybody's down, there's got to be something in your brain that tells you, no, it's okay to stand up. Did you feel some kind of special protection, or did you just have some guts in that moment? What possessed you?
What possessed me was the gun was firing and men was getting hit on both sides of us. And some was getting behind me that where the bullets were dropping. I don't know why I would do it. I'm really a chicken at heart. I just felt that something had to be done. And the sergeant was in charge. There was no way for him. He could stand up, but he was going to get shot. That machine gun nest was probably about 1,000 yards ahead of us. And they was dug in good. That air-cooled 30 puts out a lot of lead in a short while. And I didn't fire. I had a belt of ammunition around my shoulder, and I didn't fire all of it until it knocked them out. So it was just a very few seconds. They're powerful. They're powerful.
Well, the Silver Star speaks for itself, but we also want to get the story of the Purple Heart and the story of Harmon's experiences at the Battle of the Bulge, so we'll do that when we come back. For the home stretch of Hometown Heroes today, this is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
The time always goes quickly on this program, Hometown Heroes, probably a lot faster than a long truck drive, which Harmon Atwater knows a lot about. He is a semi-retired trucker who still saddles up every summer for a few more miles on the road, and he put in some serious miles in Europe during World War II. Let's talk about the Battle of the Bulge now. Of course, you didn't know it was going to be the Battle of the Bulge when it happened, but you were actually on a rest period. You were off the lines for a period of 7 days or so when you heard, uh-oh, we're needed right away.
We were in Metz, France. We were in barracks, three-story high barracks that the Germans had just left. I think that was their training base. So we moved in there, and it was pretty nice. Been on the line since the 9th of June, and this was November, we moved in there. And the 17th, we got notice to move out. So we got saddled up and loaded trucks. It was about 50 trucks. So they took us 50 miles towards Belgium. We didn't know where we was going, and we didn't know why at the time. They took us up there about 50 miles, unloaded, and put us to walking. They'd send them trucks back for another load. We walked for 5 days and nights, stopped and sleep a little bit, but never undressed. Slept in a snowbank or wherever you could. The last night before we hit combat, we could hear the guns. We could hear the artillery for about 3 days because they was, 15, 20 miles from the lines. Man, you'd hear them guns firing, you'd duck down, and then we'd laugh. We'd say, well, it must be a long ways away. But it got pretty close. And then we get on the trucks again. So I think Metz to where we landed in Belgium was pretty close to 200 mile, and you was constantly on the move, either walking or riding, and very little sleep. And good food, because we ate K rations.
And how cold was it?
Oh, it wasn't too cold. It was snow and ice, but it run around 20 degrees or so.
Nothing for a guy from Maine, huh?
No, nothing, no problem at all. And go back a little bit, my mother and my grandmother with great hand in knitting, gloves, mittens, socks, and my wife made sure I got them. I bet I was the only one walking them nights with nice woolen socks on, woolen mittens, and that was a great help.
And I don't want to exaggerate, but is it fair to say that maybe that saved you from experiencing the frozen feet or frostbite that other guys did in those times?
A lot to do with it, but a lot to do. I worked in the woods a lot after I got out, and before I got out of high school. My dad was a woodworker and cut wood and logs. We go to the woods for the day, and we always carried extra socks, extra mitts. And so at noontime, when you build a little fire and heat the tea kettle of, or a can of water for tea or coffee, we change our socks because we've been sweating, been working. And this stuck with me forever. Today it would happen if I hit a cold spot. But
so you did that in the Army too?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And there was no problem getting new socks. You just, they was at your, all you had to do was pick them up. I carried 6 or 8 pair in my pack. The light, it wouldn't weigh, the whole thing wouldn't weigh a pound. Then the problem the young men were having, frozen feet, toes, and hands. And I helped a lot of young men by giving them socks because you sweat. Your feet sweat when you're walking. When you're riding, you just get cold. But when you're walking, they sweat. And when it turns cold at night, then you got problems with your feet because you don't have dry socks. But just after we got in combat, they issued us galoshes, boots with buckles on them, and they go over your combat boots. Well, that was a godsend, because that kept the cold out. But Paul, during the day you'd be marching and you'd see hundreds of pairs of those galoshes sewed to one side. And I'm thinking, I hung mine on my pack because I'd take them off during the day when it was dry snow. And I think, well, at night, them boys are going to wish they had them because you're going to sleep in the same temperature you're in walking in.
I've talked to a lot of guys who experienced frozen feet, and my late grandfather was in the medical corps at the Bulge and said that's almost all he treated was frozen feet. I'm glad to know you didn't deal with that. One thing I'd like to get you to share before we run out of time here, and we got to talk about your Purple Heart too, but Christmas in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge, seems to be a very memorable experience for you. Tell me about that Christmas 1944.
That Christmas, we were dug in. The snow was probably 3 and 4 feet deep, and you dig down to find a spot, and the ground was froze down 2 or 3 feet, so there wasn't no way you could dig a foxhole. Christmas Eve, there's nothing going on, nobody's moving, and we're thinking, well, tomorrow will be the same. the Germans were facing the same problems we were having, so there wasn't much fighting going on. And the old sergeant comes by and he said, "We're going to have a Christmas dinner shortly." And we all laughed, like, "You got special K rations, you know?" And it wasn't, I guess, around noontime. Here come a Jeep, chains on all four wheels, and a trailer loaded with cans, big containers of food, turkey, mashed potatoes, everything that you need for Christmas dinner. And this is, I mean, really a great treat. It lifted our morale, you know, and God knows it needed it. But what kind of stuck in my mind was there was three men to a Jeep, and they was saying, "Eat fast, boys." They was wanting to get out of there because they were shelling us, you know. But I thought, well, we'd say, "Well, stick around, enjoy your meal." And they'd say, "Well, we got other place to go." Well, they did for other troops. But that was an amazing thing, that we had people thinking behind us that knew that would boost our morale. But can you imagine sitting in snow and ice? At that time, probably it was 10 below zero. It was quite amazing. Somebody planned way ahead on that.
And clearly it meant something to you. And I imagine as you sat there and ate that turkey in the snow, you probably thought, "What are my wife and son doing back home in America?"
That was good. Now, I got something to say about a concentration camp. And I can't remember the date, but it was long in the spring. I think it was in just before the war ended, May the 8th. No, it must have been April. We was in Austria. And near Linz, Austria, it's a pretty good city, divided by, I think, the Mainz River. We were moving. We hadn't run into much resistance. They was on the run, and the Germans were. And we walked into this large clearing. There was about 16, 17 of us, and we walked into it was a concentration camp. The gates were open, and poor guys were standing there, and the weather started to warm, so the snow was dissipating, and they were just standing there, and we stopped, you know, preparing for some problems, and there was nothing, and they just stood there, and that was the saddest thing I think I ever seen. And there was something like 10,000 men in that camp. Well, now, Paul, here's what happened. We had an objective we were headed for, and this camp surprised us. Somebody must have knew it was there, but we weren't informed. We was only there maybe 35, 40 minutes. And while we stayed there, we reported back, our sergeant reported back to headquarters what he'd run into. I'd say within 40 minutes, we had to leave. Within 40 minutes, there was two kitchens set up in that gate, feeding them men. You know, that really cut into me.
To see people in those miserable conditions and to understand what the enemy had been doing to them, huh?
And they didn't dare. We tried to talk to them, but they didn't understand us, and we didn't understand them. But they didn't dare to come out because they thought it was a trap. But when they see the kitchens moving in, and we unloaded our K rations and everything, it was, like I said, about 17 of us, and we had K rations for a week on us, and we just passed them out. And you know what hit me, too, was the men that were able to move and were strong, they run back in, given to the guys that couldn't walk.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I kind of hear you saying that reminded you what you were there for, and one of the reasons you guys were doing what you were doing.
Yeah, that took care of all my problems that I'd run across and would run across if we could do that. But I was so proud, the American Army, they moved them kitchens in. And I would imagine after we left, there'd probably more come. Because, like I said, there was about 10,000 in there. That's what I was told. They fed them, the ones that could eat, and I would imagine that they couldn't hold much. Their stomachs had shrunk to nothing, you know. But that was a highlight and a sad thing that hit me. And the few of us that was there stayed together until the war was over, and then I never see him again. But that was brought up a lot of times. And each one had seen something different. They would bring it up and say, "Do you remember?" And I'd say, "I didn't see that." That was quite a feat. The Army just moved them kitchens in, an old cook and maybe two or three helpers come in with the Jeeps and set them up and nothing flat.
And saved a lot of lives in the process. And I can tell how powerful that is for you even now. Well, we still haven't gotten the story of your Purple Heart, so we better do that because we're running out of time on the program here. The Battle of the Bulge didn't end till January 25th of 1945, and it was about 10 days before that that you were wounded.
We was in a wooded area, and a shell burst, and a number of men were wounded. When a shell hit the tree bursts plus the shell, so you get it double treatment, and I get hit in the right hand. When the ambulance come to pick up the others that got hit, they took us back to Luxembourg City, Luxembourg. Had a big, large hospital there. And I didn't find out till after I was there a day or so that it was the German troops were there too that had been wounded. They were in separate rooms, but they were connected. But that was a pleasant stay because I wasn't bedridden and I had a sore hand for a few days. But I got to add this little ditty. I was laying on my bed the second night there, and I heard the nurses talking, mostly the women nurses. They were talking about midnight they were going for supper. And I brightened up and I said, "Well, where do you go for supper?" They said, "To the kitchen, just down the next floor." And I said, "Well, they'd feed somebody else that's hungry." And they both said, "Come on with us. You want to eat? You bet." So I went down with them, and I hadn't had a decent meal or didn't taste good. Went down to the kitchen, and the old cook comes out, and he said, "What do you want, soldier?" And I said, "Man," I said, "I'll have me a stack of pancakes." He brought me out about 6 or 8 pancakes, and nurses was laughing, you know. And I ate that, boy, it tastes good. And I'm leaned back in the seat, and my stomach began to boil. And I said, "Is there a restroom around here?" And they said, "Right there." And I went in there, and I lost the whole thing. But I come back, and they want to know. He said, "You all right?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And the cook come out, and he said, "Well, can I get you something light?" I said, "I'll have me another stack of pancakes."
Didn't learn your lesson, or you're just priming the pump, one of the two. Well, and that's a lighthearted story from that stay in the hospital, but that took you off the lines for the rest of the Battle of the Bulge. And what do you think is the significance of that, being off the lines for 20 days?
Let me say this. I knew probably 15 guys when I got hit. And I come back on the line in Sarlaten, Germany, right on the Siegfried line. And there was one man that I knew, and he was a cook, Sammy Rikarski. And the rest were all gone. I don't know whether they were killed or wounded, but there was never heard from them again. So I always felt that 20 days off the line probably saved my life, probably did.
And I'm thankful for it because you're here talking to me today and we're just about out of time, but I have to ask you what it felt like after the war ended and you actually got to come home and see your wife again, and see a little boy that you really hadn't gotten the chance to know.
that was an amazing thing to come home. And by this time, little boy was 2 years old. They knew I was on my way. They didn't know what time. But when I went to the door, Don threw the door open, that little boy just jumped in my arms. I mean, I thought he'd be shy and maybe hide behind his mother or something, but it was just like I never left, almost.
That's a special memory, clearly. And now you have 4 children, 17 grandchildren, great-grands, and even some great-great-grandchildren to be proud of. When you look back, do you ever wonder why you were so blessed, why you got to come back, why you avoided the fate that so many others did suffer?
Yes, I've often wondered, but it was nothing that I did. It was, I think the good Lord had plans for me. I think the good Lord has plans for everybody. He has plans for you, Paul. I think it just wasn't my time. And I got to add this. When I was in Winterberg, Czechoslovakia, when the war ended, May 8, 1945, the sun was shining. It was like May. It was just like it is in northern Maine in May. Snow's gone. Flowers are coming out. They have a bulletin board wherever you go, you know, in the armed forces. And on the bulletin board, they was asking for volunteers for 6 months for occupational troops. And I'm thinking, man, I ain't fit to come home.
Because of everything you'd been through, you weren't the same person.
I wasn't fit to come home and take over married life, you know. So I wrote Dawn, asked her if she thought that it would be all right if I took 6 months occupation troop. And she writes back and she said, whatever you want to do, you go ahead. That was the best move I'd made, ever made. I stayed there 6 months and I got a job driving truck, hauling troops around France and Germany and Austria, wherever. I just unwound so that I felt so good about being who I was then. Because I read in the Stars and Stripes all the time about men that get discharged early, maybe 6 months or a year out of combat, and went home and had such problems and some of them killed themselves. This sort of haunted me because I was in bad shape. And for me, that wasn't right. So I stayed there and met a lot of nice people. And I dealt with a lot of German prisoners, worked around them, you know, and they were such nice guys. It just unwound. And I come home and never had a minute's trouble. And I don't have no flashbacks either that a lot of guys say they do have. I dream a lot about driving truck or family or whatever, but I never dream about army life.
Well, I think you're right. God had other plans for you, and he's been mighty good to you. And it's been a privilege and a blessing to share this time with you, Harmon. Thank you very much for serving our country. And keep on laying that oil on the roads for us, will you?
Oh, yeah.
That's Harmon Atwater. And if you'd like to see some photos of Harmon, see a picture of he and his wife of 68 years, Dawn, go to our website, kmjnow.com. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.